Hello, I'm Melanie Tate, and welcome to Books and Arts. Now, 6 days a week, Monday to Friday, with Michael Cathcart at 10, and here on Saturdays with me. Today, a look at the beauty artists make out of violence and death. But first, we look to the light and the work of James Turrell. Imagine for a moment you're inside a room. You're surrounded by three or four of your favourite friends and you're looking up towards the roof and it's transforming. It's pink one moment, then it's purple, and then it's blue. You're actually inside James Turrell's Sky Space at the National Gallery of Australia, and I can't tell you what an inadequate description that was of such a beautiful place. Turrell's work is difficult to talk about as it needs to be experienced, but we've never let that sort of a challenge get in our way here at Books and Arts. Here's a description of how he works from the man himself.
Well, first of all, I'm very interested in light, and like many people who are, there are young men who at one time thought about being firemen and then did it. I had this early interest in light and fascination with it and stayed with it. So it's something that has been with me all the time. I never started as a painter or anything else, but just wanted to work with light. But the difficulty is, how do you form it? You can't form it like you form clay or warm wax. You can't carve it away like wood or stone. And you don't assemble it or weld it together like with steel and assemblages. So working with it is a bit like working with sound. And I had a long time before I really sort of found my pace or found my way with it, because I didn't really want to have it inside something contained in glass or scrim. I wanted you to be looking at light. I'm interested in the thingness of light. So this idea of bringing out its physicality or its materiality is something that lets light be the revelation itself.
That's artist James Turrell there talking about his work. And the curator of James Turrell, a retrospective, is Lucina Ward from the National Gallery of Australia. Lucina joins us now. Thanks and welcome to Books and Arts, Lucina.
Thank you, Melanie.
James Turrell's art is hard to pin down to description, but I wonder if we could start, if you could describe what sort of person James Turrell is.
Oh, he's one of those extraordinary individuals that, as I think you can hear from him speaking, kind of lures you in. He's got an extraordinary range of interests, and his background means that his work is particularly compelling. He's brought up as a Quaker, and his background and training as a pilot also informs his practice. He studies perceptual psychology and mathematics, and the art comes later. So he is this extraordinarily well-rounded individual, and you can see a lot of his interests and indeed his sense of humour in the exhibition in Canberra.
Lucina, it seems a curious relationship for the National Gallery of Australia to have with an American light artist. I wonder how it came about.
We've been working with Turrell for more than 10 years now, and part of it comes about from when, in the late 1990s, we decided that it would be a very good opportunity to update the sculpture garden, to look at a work of installation art that could be outside. And we struck on James Turrell's work, and we initially had a much smaller, simpler space, and over the extended period of the conception of that work, it changed in so that it's now fully integrated into a new garden, part of the gallery's ambition to take the sculpture garden all the way round the building. And so in working with James, we settled on the idea that, you know, Canberra's role as a place for astronomy, as a place for in which the natural environment is very important, and the way in which his work Within Without came together to represent kind of Eastern, Western and Indigenous traditions just seemed to really beautifully encapsulate what we were trying to do.
Now, for any understanding of the sheer ambition of James Turrell's work, I guess we have to look at his magnum opus, the Roden Crater. Are you able to, it's difficult, isn't it, to paint a picture of this work, because it's just so huge.
It's one of the most extraordinary and ambitious and compelling and slightly mad projects that there is. Not many artists take on an extinct volcano in the edge of the Painted Desert in which to build a total work of art. And Terrell's been working on that project since the mid-1970s. It's absorbed a huge amount of his time and energy and funds. It's not yet complete, although a good part of it is complete. And when it is finished and open to the public, it will compose some 20 rooms. At the moment, there are two beautiful and very large sky spaces, one at the centre, at the eye of the crater, and a second, which has the most exquisite golden walkway that goes up into the central part of the crater. It's got a huge alpha tunnel, which stretches almost a third of a kilometre. And what he's doing in that space is making a series of viewing spaces, a naked eye observatory, so that it is, if you will, an extended version of a sky space. But the sky spaces are just one component. When it's complete, it will have wedge works, cross-corner constructions, an amphitheatre, objects that capture the light in a whole series of ways. So it stretches from astronomical events that happen every day, like dawn and dusk, to several that are much rarer and may well not happen in our lifetime.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you. Will James Tyrrell be able to finish it in his lifetime? He's 71 years old now and has been working on it, like you said, since the 70s.
The plans for the crater have stayed remarkably consistent over the time. He's made some changes, some sections have been reworked, but he's really very confident now that he could, if funding commitments stay good, because of course it's not a project that it relies on his own money and contributions from donors and further afield. He's confident if things stay well, he can finish it in 3 to 4 years. But more to the point, he's also developed a whole series of very complex and detailed plans that mean that, if necessary, the project could go on without him. But in the meantime, he goes on with a number of other wonderful projects all around the world, and those, you know, as Within Without does, inform and build into that broader master plan.
Lucina, how then do you put together a retrospective for the National Gallery of Australia for an artist whose works are so very site-specific in many cases?
It is challenging. We built a large number of spaces, as the artist himself says. You know, when you work with light, you need to shape everything around it. And it was a very, very complex and ambitious undertaking. We calculated that it was the equivalent of building 3 houses in 11 weeks. Wow. And we'd like to say that, you know, the block's got nothing on us, because the level of finish that we required just to have those works operate just so is, you know, no mean feat. So that means we were particularly thrilled when Terrell declared it one of his most beautifully constructed exhibitions ever.
Lucina, installation work can be a little intimidating for the art lover who's more comfortable visiting the gallery to see one of the blockbusters. Now, how would you encourage the timid among art lovers to make the trip to Canberra to see this?
The whole experience of Terrell's work is what makes it. Walking into a Gansfield, for example, which is the largest work in the exhibition, of a footprint of about 8 by 16 metres, you enter a space which externally is quite deceptive. It almost looks like a simple square of light in the space. And it's not even that obvious when you're sitting waiting and you need to remove your shoes and put on some booties and wait a little while and walk up the stairs. It's not even clear until the last moment, even when people tell you, and you know it's coming yourself, that you're just going to be suffused, submerged, surrounded by this extraordinary light. It's quite a otherworldly bodily experience. You know, people can feel really quite discombobulated in the space. But I think what makes that work so compelling is, you know, you really don't often get the opportunity to feel in an art gallery like you're walking on clouds, or indeed you're almost flying above clouds. These works of art have a kind of component to them that is the sheer experience, the sheer joy of interacting with these works of art. But they also, you know, Terrell attracts us in with colour and light, but there's a moment when our rational brains take over and we try to to explain some of these works of art to ourselves. There are many wonderful tricks, some of which are fairly obvious after a little while. Others, you know, you need to leave your rational brain at the door in some cases and actually just give it over to the experience.
Lucina Ward, the curator of the James Turrell retrospective at the National Gallery of Australia in Canberra. And a final word now from the man himself, James Turrell.
I was interested in just looking out the window. I was noticing that sometimes with a white surround, I could, if I had light around it at night, you can make that window absolutely black. You can't see through it. So vision is stopped. It's just like when light illuminates the atmosphere and you can't see through the sky during the day to see the stars that are actually there. But as soon as that light is taken away, sunset, you start to see this vision penetrates through the atmosphere where it was blocked before.
The James Turrell exhibition runs until June, and do get along. The NGA is even running a competition that could see you at the Rodin Crater itself in Arizona. For more details and photos of this work that's very difficult to capture, go to our website. I'm Melanie Tate. You're listening to Books and Arts, now with you 6 days a week. Coming up, how the most shocking of crimes inspired women across the world to join hands and create some really gorgeous speculative fiction. A horrific event in India spurred a cross-cultural partnership that developed into a book written and illustrated by women for teen readers from India and Australia. The book is called Eat the Sky, Drink the Ocean, and I'm joined by two of the editors, Australian writer Kirsty Murray, who's in our Melbourne studio, and Indian writer, editor and publisher Anita Roy, who's on the phone from Delhi. Kirsty, let's start with you. What was this horrific event that set this collaboration in motion?
Well, it was actually two horrific events that coincided. In September 2012, Jill Maher, who everybody here at the ABC knew and loved, died a horrible death, the death we fear for all our daughters. And in Delhi in December, there was a particularly horrific rape and murder of a beautiful young Indian girl who was innocently on her way home and got taken onto a bus and really brutally gang-raped, and then she died in a Singapore hospital. I mean, the whole world was ill about that particular crime. It got international media. And, of course, here in Melbourne, people were heartbroken about what happened to Jill Maher. And there were vigils in Delhi over the Delhi rape. There were vigils here in Melbourne at the same time about, you know, this longing to make a better world for our daughters and our sisters. And it was very moving as we were actually, Anita and I were talking about doing another project together. We've known each other for some time, and Anita published an earlier book of mine called The Lilliputians in India, which was called India Dark in Australia. And so we were talking about the next thing we wanted to do together, but it was like there were these huge massing clouds of emotional distress over these two incidences, and that made us think particularly about how can things be better? How do women frame these conversations? I think Anita should actually talk about that side of it too from her perspective, because she was the one that was so insistent that this anthology had to be all female, because we did talk about having... Yes, you did. You said it has to be all women for this collection.
So, Anita, why so? Why was it so important to you that it's all women for this collection?
Well, partly because I work for a feminist publishing house, Young Zibon, and what we do is try and give a space for female voices particularly to be heard. And partly because what Kirsty and I talked about and what we got very excited about was this idea of actually asking writers to write speculative fiction. And I think science fiction and fantasy and graphic novels are all genres which are very dominated by male writers. And we thought it would be really interesting to see what women would do inside a genre like that and how they would kind of reclaim it as their own. How women can reimagine the world. And I think that speculative fiction idea of what if things were different? How would things be different? You know, how can we reimagine a society and a world better and more equitable. That seemed to be a very exciting prospect. It was certainly something that all of our contributors immediately got on board with. I mean, it's like a sort of editor's dream. You ask someone, dream up a list of all of your favorite writers and then ask them to write something for you. And I think every single one of them said yes.
Now, you also asked, as well as the book be speculative fiction, as well as being written by all women from across India and Australia, you also wanted these women to work together on the book. So was it also about forging international alliances? And why was this an important part of the project?
When we started working on this, it was such an unusual left field idea, mm-hmm. too. And we were approaching really established, successful authors within their genres, and we needed to fund it. We were lucky enough to apply and receive a creative partnerships with Asia grant. And I was quite pleased that the criteria for that, for the grant, said we would favour something that was collaborative. And Anita and I said, oh, how collaborative can we get? Let's go to an even higher level and ramp it up and make everybody work together, not just the writers and illustrators, but let's get the writers and writers collaborating, and let's have a party with in cyberspace on Skype and email with 20 women. So it was a pretty wild way to approach putting a book together, really.
So how did this collaboration actually work, Anita? Was it completely Skype-based?
It worked mostly in cyberspace, a little bit with phone calls, a lot of emailing and backing and forthing. And basically what we said to each of the contributors, I mean, Payal, Dhar and Kirsty and I, the editors, kind of sat together like, I don't know, a kind of cross between fairy godmothers and Indian matchmakers looking for good, suitable arranged marriages to these ladies, and trying to match people that we thought would just have a good time together and who whose work we knew would kind of speak to each other. One of the things that I think took us all by surprise, although I'm not quite sure why, writers and creative artists are generally very solitary beings. You know, they kind of go into a corner and sit on their own and do their thing in their head. And we were a bit worried at the beginning as to how they would take to this idea of having a kind of mate to do their stuff with. And I think that one of the things we discovered was not that they all have a really, really good time with it, bouncing ideas back and forth, getting feedback on their own stories. In Kirsty and Manjula Padmanabhan's case, actually coming up with a play, which they sort of jointly wrote. It was also, I think, part of the thing about it being an all-women collection. I'm not sure if it were men in there, they would have been quite so open and quite so cooperative and quite so free and easy with their ideas and their time and their thoughts.
I wonder, though, and this is a question for both of you, perhaps Kirsty, you can answer it first. As editors, was it a tough job bringing everyone together, picking who might work together, etc.?
It felt harder when we started, actually. As Anita said, a lot of people fell in love with each other, and some people just surprised us by how intense their working relationship was. Some people, for all sorts of other reasons, didn't get a chance to build much between them. But we didn't want to be didactic and say, you have to do this, and this is what, you know, we expect of you. We really trusted in people to come up with whatever they did. So there are a couple of stories within the collection where they were more or less solo, and they just waved at each other in cyberspace. So, oh, hi, I'm over here, I'm doing this. And that was fine. And then there are other people, particularly, obviously, if it's a writer-illustrator dynamic, because there are 73 pages of graphics in the book. Their collaborations were very intense and took a lot of time. And the play script that I wrote with Manjula was an amazing adventure. For Australians who don't know her work, she's one incredibly well known in India, and she won the Onassis Prize in 1998 for an original play script. And I thought, I've got to write a play with Manjula, and she's so clever. But I learned so much from working with her.
So when you're writing a play with a prize-winning playwright, how did that dynamic work for you and her, Kirsty? How did you know the practicalities of writing a play together?
Well, Manjula said right from the outset, I don't want to collaborate with anybody. And I said, oh, well, we're meant to sort of collaborate. And she said, well, let's just play my rules. I went, okay. Her rules was to play this game that she called Consequences. I called it Exquisite Corpse, and sometimes it felt like Blind Assassin. The rules were that she would send me a piece of play script with no notes, with nothing. It was just maybe 200 words of these characters talking to each other, and I would read it, and I would then write the next 200 words and send it back to her blind, so we couldn't see. It's like you put it, it's like the children's game that where you tell a part of it and then, or unfold a piece of paper and see that there's another piece and another piece. So we did this over about 3 months to put together a play script, which eventually was about 2,500 words. And it was a really interesting process because you assume things about India and Australia, and you assume things about your differences, and in point of fact there is so much integrated symbiotic relationship happening there. That sounds all too sciencey, mm-hmm. but it was like there was, we were thinking things at the same time on different sides of the planet and interconnecting, so that it was not as surprising as I thought it would be when we actually put it together. The characters all made sense, and it didn't take as long to edit it as we needed to. And then eventually, after we'd done that, we got on Skype and we had regular Skype meetings and we read it out to each other. And so, yeah, it was a really dynamic collaboration.
So the book itself now is out. Well, it's been out in India. It's been experienced in India. Have certain stories been received differently in the different cultures?
Yeah, well, I'd say that there is a really clear difference from what I've started to read with online reviews and just talking to people about it. There's one particular story called Weft by Alyssa Brugman, which I know here in Australia, the people who've read it are a bit bewildered by it. God, that's a weird story. In India, people laughed about it. They thought it's about a young woman who sells a kidney to get hair extensions. Even though it's written with an Australian voice, I think it worked amazingly well in India. So many journalists, when I was over there last November for the release of the book, said, who is this woman? This story is so contemporary and so topical, because, of course, there is an organ trade in India that is something very alarming. And the idea that you would start to sell your body parts to alter other parts of your body just seemed incredible. So that story, I think, in India floats differently, whereas here the stories that people pick up on, and it's a bit early to say which they'll go for, but they tend to go for the things that you recognise that speak to you.
What do you hope will come out of this book?
I think one of the things that I really hope comes out of it is a lot more discussion and a lot more imaginative and different responses to this question of gender. One of the things that I think has happened in the last 2 years, really kind of triggered by that terrible rape case, is that the discourse around women and girls and their sexuality and safety and all of that has really shifted a lot in the public discourse here, from a question of how do we protect girls, how do we increase safety measures, how do we make them safer, to how do we construct a society where boys and men don't do this. The onus seems to have shifted far much more from protecting women to educating and looking at men and how they behave and how they view themselves, their role in society, and their wives, sisters, strangers on the street, and so on. One of the things that people can think, do think, is that feminism is all about being stern and angry and, position taking and not liking men and all of that stuff. But honestly, this collection, I would say, sort of demonstrates a completely different aspect of feminism, which is much truer. It's a dialogue and it's a way of viewing the world. And it's, as you will see from the stories, it can be funny, outer spacey, time travel-y, and all kinds of things. And as Kirsty was saying, you know, there are several of the stories which feature male protagonists.
Kirsty, what about you?
I think very much similar to Anita, you just hope it opens up a conversation, because what I loved about this book is that none of the stories are didactic. None of the stories tell you what to think or how to think. It's not a book for girls. It's a book for people who like to think. And so what I really hope is that it provokes conversation.
Kirsty Murray and Anita Roy, thank you so much for your time today on Books and Arts.
Thank you, Melanie.
Thank you.
Kirsty Murray and Anita Roy are two of the editors of the book Eat the Sky, Drink the Ocean, published by Allen and Unwin. This is Books and Arts on RN. I'm Melanie Tate. a set designer had to design the dream studio for an artist in a big Hollywood movie. You know that big Hollywood movie about an artist? The set designer would have a tough time dreaming up anything as special as Guy Maestri's studio. It's huge. It's all high ceilings and light and comfortable couches and energetic art by Guy and his friends all over the walls. Also in his studio are a couple of freezers, which are more than curios or a space to store ice cubes. Inside these fridges are various dead animals. Birds, mostly, but also a koala and an echidna. These animals have been picked up from the sides of roads all over Australia, and Guy has been finding the beauty in roadkill now for a couple of years in his painting, even winning awards for it. So where did this fascination start?
I probably started before I was even a painter, actually. The only way you ever get to... And I've always had a real fascination for nature as a kid, for, you know, birds, whatever, you know. It's something you can never really get close to, in a way. The only time I could ever actually really stop and observe closely, say, a beautiful king parrot or something like that, is if you found it on the road dead. So I've sort of always done that. But then again, you get to spend a few minutes with this incredible thing and then you sort of throw it back on the ground. You almost develop an attachment in those few minutes because it's something that's so exquisite, but it's dead, of course. When I started painting out in the field, and obviously when you spend a lot of time driving around in the outback or wherever, there's so much of it. You know, out in most country areas, there's just so much death on the road that it sort of became the next logical step in documenting an area, I guess. Different areas you move through, you can actually understand what's there by what you find on the road. So there was that sort of documentation thing. Also, there was the idea that I could then, because I was really only painting plein air or from life, I could bring these things into the studio, sort of revive my studio practice, because I hadn't really used my studio to make work for maybe a couple of years. So I brought these things into the studio and it was a very different way of working. It's something that you can control, the light, control the space, the composition. You know, it became sort of more theatrical, I guess. I mean, and that's that whole tradition of still lifes, beautifully sort of staged things that are representing the time or the wealth of somebody or the produce or, you know, all that sort of thing. The pressure that the environment's under from human beings is an obvious example. Other than that, it was just a way of making work in the studio and having a little bit more control over the conditions, because I spent a year struggling in trying circumstances, being, you know, sunburnt and drenched and eaten by insects and all that sort of stuff, which was really, you know, I needed to come back to the studio. And of course then once people started to see what I was doing, they started to bring things, dead things to me, which is an interesting thing to be known for, I guess, you know. So yeah, subsequently I've got an interesting freezer in my studio.
Bringing them back to the studio, there's all sorts of legalities then that arise too with native fauna.
Yeah, there is. It's strictly controlled. For example, you can't get any native species taxidermied without a license. Technically, you really can't have possession of any dead native species. So yeah, I do. I bring them back to my studio. I paint them. Then I bury them. It's a way of preserving them or somehow respecting them and giving them some longevity. That's my, what's the word, rationality.
We're going to have a little look at your freezer, but tell me about the sorts of dead things that people bring you. And I just want to know as well how this transaction takes place. Like, do your friends see things dead on the side of the road and bring things?
Dark alleys, you know, in the middle of the night, we do the drop. I guess I have a lot of friends who spend a lot of time in the country. It's funny, once you start looking Once that's your awareness, you notice how much there is. Or if you do see it, most people are conditioned to just immediately look away from something. You know, I go up to Hill End a lot, to my mate Luke Scabaris's house. Last time I went up there, I was telling him that my eyeballs were sore because they're just absolutely on alert for 4 hours. And if you sort of got that focus, you see an amazing amount of dead things. Anyway, yeah, so people just bring me stuff. I tell them to put it in the freezer. And I also tell them I don't want anything that's disgusting or stinky, but that still does come at me every now and then.
When you're out there driving and you're on hyper alert all the time, how do you decide which dead thing is appealing enough for you to pull over and pick it up to be part of your art?
Well, you know, it started off just obviously with the most beautiful things, like, and we've got so many exquisite native parrots, but more and more with the foxes and so forth, there's an observation of what things are in what area. So I've got a little bit more game lately with what I will stop and pick up. I actually have something in, like a sort of airtight thing in the back of my van, which I can put things that might be questionable. Sort of weird, but like I feel like it's documentation. You know, I'm not going to shy away from these things. I think it's sort of an important observation to make about landscape. More and more, I guess I'm looking for things that might not be as just simply beautiful, things that are maybe more damaged or things you wouldn't expect to see. So, yeah, I've moved from just purely beautiful things, which have, you know, it's just they have such an ephemeral beauty. There's a window of a day between when the thing's hit by a car and when it's covered in maggots. So it's just that thing of preserving, I guess. Well, that was the initial idea behind the first series. The second series, which Jan has some more, I guess, confronting or brutal images to do with other, well, both native and feral species.
Can you describe to us the painting that we're sitting in front of now, which I think is what you're talking about then? There's something really confronting about this one.
Yeah, well, it's a dead koala and it's been hit by a car. It's not in the most pristine condition. Its face is a little bit smashed up and its eyeballs actually popping out. So, it's a confronting image, no matter what sort of animal it would be. But the fact that it's a koala bear is really something that it's a contradiction, I guess. You really expect to see in your mind the koala bear is this fluffy toy, absolutely cute, doesn't even look real, it's so, you know, it's so much like a toy. So I guess that's what, you know, makes it all the more difficult to see.
So are you going to continue with this series? Like, are you still open for business with people dropping off dead things to you?
Yeah. For example, I have a friend who lives out in just out of Wilcannia on a sheep station. He's the most softly spoken, gentle, intelligent, really, really lovely man. But he runs this sheep station, and one of his sort of almost daily jobs or routines is to go out and shoot feral animals. For example, I spoke to him the other day, and he, because he texted me saying, I shouldn't even say this on air, seriously, it's disgusting, but he's got all these dead wild dogs that he's had to shoot because they're, for example, on that morning they had killed 6 lambs. Mm. So there's an unbelievable brutality and harshness and struggle in those areas, and this guy's life sort of sees that on a daily basis. And he saw some of these paintings that I made of native and feral road kills, and so he was like, I've got all these dead feral dogs that I've had to shoot, let's do something with them. And so I'm really actually keen to take that on as a series, and I guess as an example of observing that the harshness of that area and that sort of life. So that's my next series.
Guy Maestri is just about to exhibit some of this work at the Jan Murphy Gallery in Brisbane. The exhibition is called Black Gold and it opens on the 24th of Feb and will be on until the 21st of March. To look at more of these paintings and at Guy's wide body of work, go to guymaestri.com. You're on Books and Arts, I'm Melanie Tate. It's time for some music now, and it follows on quite nicely from Guy Maestri's story. This is Sally Seltman with Catch of the Day from her album Hey Daydreamer.
Of the day, but the catch of the day caught me down the road, around the bend, and the rest is history. Hold that fish above my head and then throw back out to sea. I'm not gonna live my life being told who I'm supposed to be. Hold that fish above my head and then throw back out to sea. Hold that fish above my head and then throw back out to sea. Yeah, like the waves crashing the sand, we'll learn to understand. Rather fall than never try. Hold my hands out and I'll fly. Fly, 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 fly. Catch of the day, but the catch of the day caught me down the road, around the bend, and the rest is history. Hold that fish above my head and then throw back out to sea. I'm not gonna live my life being told who I'm supposed to be. Hold that fish above my head and then throw back out to sea. Hold that fish above my head and then throw back out to sea. All you snakes and spiders are the coolest enemies, crawling up beside me when I'm falling to my knees. I gotta fly. Catch of the day, but the catch of the day caught me down the road, around the bend, and the rest is history. Hold that fish above my head and then throw back out to sea. I'm not gonna live my life being told who I'm supposed to be. Hold that fish above my head and then throw back out to sea. I'm not gonna live my life being told who I'm supposed to be. Hold that fish above my head and then throw back out to sea. I'm not gonna live my life being told who I'm supposed to be. Hold that fish above my head and then throw it back out to sea.
Australian singer Sally Seltman, who's based in LA these days. That song you heard was Catch of the Day from her newest album, Hey Daydreamer.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America. Everything free in America. For a small fee in America.
Musical theatre performer Tony Sheldon has recently returned from the stages of Broadway, where he managed to pick himself up a Tony nomination, to Sydney. And he's going to be playing the lead role of Don Quixote in a revival of Man of La Mancha by independent musical theatre company Squabblelogic. In a major coup for the masterpiece here on Books and Arts, the multi-award winner joins us to share his favourite work of art.
Thank you.
Tony Sheldon, welcome to The Masterpiece. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Melanie.
What is the work you've decided to talk about today?
It was a very hard decision. I did decide to go with a piece of musical theatre because that's sort of my area of interest. I've decided to go with West Side Story.
Oh, terrific. Now, for anybody who, and you know, there could be a person out there somewhere who hasn't seen it and this is their first introduction to it, what is it about?
Well, of course, it's based on Romeo and Juliet by Shakespeare, but it was inspired by the turf wars of the 50s when the Puerto Ricans were moving into New York and the teenage gangs were refusing them access to the streets, basically, and a lot of lives were lost. And Jerome Robbins, the choreographer, and Leonard Bernstein, the composer, decided to put their heads together and write a serious musical using dance as the main motor of the storytelling to do a contemporary retelling of the Romeo and Juliet story.
Now, it's also the first big show for Stephen Sondheim, a young Stephen Sondheim, isn't it?
It was his first Broadway show, it was indeed. He wrote the lyrics and he was initially billed as the co-lyricist with Leonard Bernstein because Bernstein wanted to write his own lyrics. But as the project went along, they discovered that Bernstein's writing was a bit purple. it was his idea of poetry wasn't really how young people spoke. And because Sondheim was not yet 30, he brought a more authentic sound to the lyrics. And Arthur Lawrence, the playwright, virtually invented a new language for the teenagers because they couldn't use four-letter words, which was how teenagers spoke. And so it was a little bit early for that to invade the Broadway stage. So they came up with words like, you know, cut the frabba jabba and, you know, oobly-oo for the girls and things like that. So it was very new. It was also one of Harold Prince's first jobs as a producer, and it made stars of people like Cheetah Rivera and Carol Lawrence and Larry Kurt. So it launched a lot of very illustrious careers.
So we know it today as legendary, and probably a lot of people have been introduced to it through the movie with Natalie Wood in it. But at the time, how was it received initially on the Broadway stage?
It was an audience favourite. Young people adored it because it spoke to them. It was a very sexy show. There were kids up there wearing tight jeans and low-cut dresses, and there was this hot dancing to mambo music. But the critics were a little bit nonplussed by it. It certainly was ahead of its time, and it took for the production to go to London before audiences really embraced it there. And then, of course, the film brought it to a much, much wider audience a few years later and won 10 Academy Awards. But it's one of those shows that over the years has just continued to gain in prestige. And it's interesting that Jerome Robbins' choreography is sort of part of the contract when you do the show in mainstream productions. It's you have to keep reproducing that choreography. And I think that's a good idea. I'm a purist. I know a lot of people would disagree with me, but I think the choreography is a very large part of the reason of its success and what makes it so thrilling to this day.
How would you describe the choreography? How does he have these gangs dancing?
Well, because it's heightened, it's stylized, and because the music is almost classical, it is wonderful music. The dance music, I think, is probably the best part of the score, and the orchestrations, largely by Erwin Kostel, make up a large part of that. It is ballet, so it represents the violence in balletic terms, but Robbins was very canny in bringing in Peter Gennaro as his co-choreographer, who took the Sharks, the Puerto Rican gang members, into another room. And so the Jets and the Sharks were choreographed separately.
Oh, great.
And there was a wonderful moment when they did the dance at the gym in rehearsal, and they brought the two together and they actually saw each other's choreography for the first time. And so there was a real sense of competition developed by Jerome Robbins. He wouldn't let the cast members from the opposite gangs socialise. They weren't allowed to have lunch together. He continually pinned news reports of gang wars and murders in the street up on the walls, so people were steeped in this rivalry. Indeed, in various productions, the Jets and the Sharks, there was a lot of hostility between the cast members, and fights used to erupt. And so all that comes through in the dancing. So it's ballet, but with a real underlined violence to it.
Tony, when did you first discover West Side Story?
Interestingly, the London production. My parents had gone to London to try and get work over there. My parents are performers, Tony Lamond, and my dad was a dancer, Frank Sheldon, which is probably why I have such a great interest in dance shows. And we saw the West End production, which was the hot ticket at the time. And I can still remember flashes of it, even though I was four, specifically a wonderful transition moment when Maria first tries on her dress for the dance at the gym, and she says, "Tonight I will be the most beautiful girl there," and she starts twirling, and she twirls off, and the music starts to twirl, and the lights all change, and suddenly a series of girls in coloured dresses are all twirling across the stage, and streamers descend from the flies, and there's this transition into the dance that was one of the most thrilling things I have ever seen, and that has stayed with me. Lo these many years, since, 1959. So that was my first introduction. And then to see the Australian production, which came out in 1960 with a largely American cast, because it changed the bar of how to cast a musical. Everybody had to be able to sing that Leonard Bernstein score, which he wrote at the same time as he was writing Candide. So it's a big sing. Mm-hmm. Everybody had to be able to dance, be genuine dancers. They had to be able to act convincingly and look like teenagers. So it completely changed the face of how Broadway musicals were cast. And, of course, now we all take it for granted. Everybody can do everything like that. But in those days, they certainly couldn't.
Tony, did you ever perform in it?
No, I'm not good enough. I'm not. I've never been able to dance like that. The range for those the boys' roles are very, very high to sing. And of course, I'm now well over the age I would have been able to do it. But there were never any major productions of it when I was the right age to do it anyway.
Right.
And the most recent really good production that got it right was the one that Ian Judge presented in, I think, 2002, when Carolyn O'Connor played Anita, and it really put her on the map. It was an extraordinary performance, and that got her career going all around the world, really. And the show continues to make stars. There was Arthur Lawrence reconceived the show in 2009 for Broadway, mm-hmm. and he decided to make the Sharks that they would all speak Spanish all the way through it, which further made the rift between the two gangs that if you were an English-speaking audience member, you actually didn't understand a lot of what was being said, which the Jets wouldn't have, so it would have further alienated them. It was a wonderful concept, and the girl who played Anita in that production won the Tony Award. And there's just now been a new recording with the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra, which was nominated for a Grammy only 2 weeks ago. So it's still out there raising the bar, changing the rules, and continuing to thrill audiences.
What do you think is the secret behind its longevity? Is it simply harking back to the fact that it's from a Shakespeare story and Shakespeare's still around for it? There's something universal? Or what do you think is the reason?
I think that by making it relatable to young people, which was the genius of the Jerome Robbins Bernstein Sondheim version, and injecting that music, especially the dance music, which I think is timeless. I can be surfing radio stations and I will hear the Somewhere ballet or the Dance at the Gym, and the hair on the back of my neck just goes up. It's truly the most thrilling music, I think, written for the theatre to this day. And sadly, bigotry, racism, violence between young people, that blind violence simply because it's people of a different colour or a different race or a different religion or just difference, whatever. And there's that song called Somewhere, which is there's a place for us, somewhere a place for us, peace and quiet and open air. You know, it's a message that relates to people of difference. To gay people have taken it up as an anthem that, you know, when are we all just going to be able to live together and not have to, you know, be violent? It's a message that seems never to go away.
Tony, if somebody is coming to West Side Story for the first time from our discussion today, it is actually a musical that you can get into by listening to the soundtrack. Which recording would you recommend they seek out in order to get excited by this musical?
I still think the original 1957 Broadway cast album is almost unmatched in terms of excitement. The orchestrations in the 2009 Broadway revival are pretty sparkling and beautiful, but I've just listened to the San Francisco one, and Alexandra Silber as Maria and Cheyenne Jackson as Tony, I think, are probably definitive in terms of singing those roles. So there's a bit of everything, but I always hark back to that original Broadway one. I don't recommend the film version, but I think that if you can get that Broadway production, it's still the best.
Tony Sheldon, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
And we're halfway there. Hold my hand and I'll take you there. Somehow, someday, somewhere.
Musical theatre legend Tony Sheldon joining me for the masterpiece this afternoon. And if you're in Sydney, Tony can be seen as Don Quixote in Man of La Mancha at the Seymour Centre. It kicks off next Wednesday, February 25, and you'll be able to find out all those details online. That's Books and Arts for today. Remember, you can always catch us online where you can stream or download all your favourite interviews as well as leave your comments. On Facebook, just look for ABCRN Books and Arts. And you can also drop us a line on Twitter too. Our handle is @RNBooksAndArts. Make sure you head to the Books and Arts homepage and check out the great list of 11 titles we'll be covering on this year's Subcontinent Book Club. Now, it kicks off next week on Friday with Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things. So you've still got time to get a copy and get reading if you'd like to be part of it. I'm Melanie Tate. Have a lovely Saturday. It's news time.